Okay, thanks for this kind introduction. Dear colleagues, I feel honored to be the first keynote speaker of this most important German conference with an international audience, as it was called. This is not... Something is wrong here. Sorry. This is where we start. Right. Now, in order to be up to this role, I've prepared a presentation in which I will try to do what Michael Höppner asked for, rethinking the library. So I called this From Containers to Content to Context. I could have called it Rethinking the Library. And this is what I will try to do in the half an hour that I have. I will start from the pre-Gutenberg area, an area where content and content creation, content management and content creation were quite closely connected. I will then go into what has been called the Gutenberg parenthesis, how the container and the content have been dissociated for quite some centuries, a parenthesis which is currently closing again. So we live the end of the print paradigm, and this has consequences for documents and data in e-science and e-scholarship. This is about context then, and this creates opportunities for libraries, which I will use to conclude. Now, this is what the Library of Alexandria may have looked like. We don't really know. We do know who were the librarians of Alexandria. These were people like Xenodotus, Callimachus, Erastosthenes. These were people that were scholars and or poets and or librarians. So these two roles were not dissociated back in Alexandria. And neither were they here in this monastery, which has never been built, but there exists a plan for a monastery of St. Gall. And if you have a look at that plan, the first thing that strikes you is that it all seems to be about beer. There are three breweries there. But actually, when you approach the center of this monastery, you get to this red rectangle here, which if you zoom into it, again, combines two roles. It has here the seats of the scribes, the scriptorium, and here, above it, the library. So once again, a very close combination of these two roles. Now, this was over with Gutenberg, because the invention of print led to a new distribution of roles and led to a dissociation of roles in what I would call the Gutenberg galaxy. A number of roles shaped in that area in the scholarly and scientific process of creating and using knowledge. And these roles have been closely associated to well-established cultural techniques, namely writing and reading. Two of them were quite closely connected, and these are the ones I will be talking about. That was the publishing and the document management role, reserved to publishers and librarians, respectively. And these remain quite stable over centuries, whether all this was turning around printed books or whether we moved into the digital emulation of print, which is PDF, or even recently with electronic documents and e-books, this distribution of roles basically remained stable, which had a consequence for the way librarians organized their work, because from the advent of print on, the functional principle was to establish between the objects users wanted to use and these users a layer of catalog data, of metadata. And here again, irrespectively of the actual object pointed to, the principle was always the same. You had users who had to go through metadata, pointing to books, analog things, digital things, and even the current Europeana portal is still working that way. So basically, as a consequence of the advent of print, there were a number of functional principles that have been established in libraries. The first of them being the mediation of access to information objects via catalogs, the mediating links as pointers from the metadata objects, objects being part of a library collection, and the internal processing logic of libraries, which was almost exclusively focused on objects as containers of information and did not so much deal with the actual information contained in these containers. And accordingly, cataloging, as was done for centuries in libraries, focused on container attributes, and our rules for cataloging reflect this. We have lots of rules about how to count pages, how to transcribe elements of a cover sheet to a cataloging record. We have almost no rules about how to actually deal with the semantics in the containers. And accordingly as well, the functional macro primitives of library information, again, were built around that container-based strategy. They were all about ingestion, storage, description, and retrieval of information containers. Now, we currently live at the end of this Gutenberg parenthesis, where we get to a situation where the individual roles are less and less determined by well-established cultural techniques. We have a disintegration of this linear, circular, functional paradigm, and the object in the center is starting to decompose. In a way, Ted Nelson had radicalized in his hypertext Xanadu vision, and in parallel, something else was happening. This is the birth certificate, if you wish, of the World Wide Web. It's the information management proposal Tim Berners-Lee made back in 1989. And this was still based on the idea that this would be a web of documents. In this document web, the constituent mechanism was this one, was the connection of two web resources by a hypertext link. Like in this example here, we have a resource Louvre, a resource La Joconde, and there is some kind of link between these two. But we're missing a number of things. We know what kind of resources Louvre and Joconde are because we have some implied knowledge, cultural background, machines don't. Neither would they be able to determine what the link is between these two objects. Here again, we can tell, we know there is a museum and there are paintings, and normally paintings are inside a museum. We can infer all that, machines can't, so we have to tell them. And this is how the document web was extended in syntax with a mechanism called RDF, Resource Description Framework, which now tells the machine that one resource is inside the other. Or more generally, it takes this form to make statements about things on the web. Now, we added a schema language to this with classes, hierarchies, inheritance, and inferencing support, which basically allows you to combine these RDF triples into meaningful so-called ontologies, which would model knowledge about a domain in the world. And we did a second extension of the web, which is an extension, this time not in syntax, but in scope, into what has been called the web of things. This is not the way it is done, We do not label the real world and make it part of the web that way. It's the other way around. This is the only really technical slide. We create a representation of a real thing, the yellow bubble at the bottom here, that would represent the Brandenburg Gate in the web, and depending on your browser's capabilities, would either lead to RDF code making statements about the Brandenburg Gate, or if you don't talk RDF, would move up here to a picture. And the RDF and the picture, again, are connected by another RDF statement saying that the one is a depiction of the other. And if you have this, you can combine these two extensions in syntax and in scope to reason, because you can take a triple like this one here, which says that a resource with the title white noise is of RDF type book, and then you take a second one which says that book is an RDFS subclass of artistic work, and you can create a third statement. A machine can do that, which would infer that white noise must be of RDF type artistic work. And there is nice potential here for scholarly heuristics. If you imagine not just 3, but 3 billion of such triples, you may get an idea of the actual potential in this idea. Now, we have two disintegration processes, the disintegrating monolith, the book, the disintegration of documents on the web, and if you combine these two, you get into new ways of dealing with documents and data. You can start publishing in a very different approach. This is a publication. It's a publication that says the red resource there has a frequency of 0.25% in a given context, and the statement has been made by people, provenance. This is what it looks like for the techies among you. It's an aggregation of RDF triples, and this is what Jan Felder-Rob calls nanopublications. And this can be used to infer. There is a very nice article published by Jan and others, which is about the way you can actually infer interaction between proteins in such publication environments using the triples and using ontologies to infer novel protein-protein interactions from literature context, as this article says. Have a look. There is a second, slightly more conservative view of what is now called semantic publishing, which is the one by David Shotton. David Shotton defines semantic publication as anything that would enhance the meaning of published journal articles, that would facilitate their discovery, that enables linking to semantically related articles, provides access to data within the articles, or simply facilitates the integration of data between articles. I have an example of such an article here for you. If it decides to work, it does not. Okay. That's a pity. Oh, it does. Yeah. Here you have an article, and you can highlight, for instance, organisms or persons or... Oh, it doesn't... Okay. I cancel it. Sorry. That's a pity. Okay, I can't show you the example. You have to trust me that you get the linked entities in this article. Now I have to get back to my presentation. Yep. You get the linked entities in this article. And this is the way it's done in the background. Actually, the text of the article is contextualized, enriched with links to all sorts of resources, databases, linked data, RDF statements on the web. And the experience created that way is an enriched article. There are tools around for doing these kind of things. OpenCalais, Temis, Colexis are just three examples. And these started as startups. They are currently owned by the big publishers, and this indicates to you where these people, Thomson Reuters, Elsevier, and others, are moving. They are moving into contextualization. You also have specialized resources you can use for contextualization. This approach has been criticized, and justly criticized, I would say, as still being quite conservative, because linking terms to HTML pages doesn't really get us much further. It's great for humans, not so good for computers. And it's still too much focused on a conventional article format. So actually, we need more. We need something the New York Times has one called liquid books, because you can do very nice things with them. This is one, well, before I get into that, you can do very nice things with them, and in contextualizing this way, you increasingly blur the boundary between data and publication. Because this very distinction between data and publication is vanishing in the kind of approaches that I've tried to show to you. And this is true, at least, in the STM sector. It will probably happen not that quickly in the social sciences and humanities for a number of reasons I'm giving here. But the examples you can find today where this kind of semantic publishing is already working can be found in the medical and biomedical area, where you have lots of ontological resources and lots of money. I'm not going into that any further, because I think that Birte will hint at some of these issues. Now, once you have this, once you have RDF, once you have big aggregations of contextualized resources, you can do nice things. You can visualize scholarly networks on that basis, like shown in this one here or in this example. And you can use such visualizations to do research. Here again, I have the problem that I will not be able to project my example, so I have to explain what you would be seeing here. There is one very nice application that has been set up in Harvard, which is based on a corpus of early Enlightenment letters sent around between 1700 and 1750 in Europe, between people like Voltaire and Hume and others. And this corpus and the relations between the sender and the addressees have been visualized in this Republic of Letters application, and that show very nicely how scientific communication actually evolved and shaped in that area of the Enlightenment. Very nice example. The other nice example that I would have liked to show is a Finnish one, which recreates, as it were, a lost part of Finland, Karelia, which has become part of Russia. And people were invited to send photos and all sorts of records of that lost part of Finland to this site and to semantically annotate them. And this creates a very, very nice knowledge environment. Now, all this creates opportunities for libraries. Because if you have resources of this volume, if you have millions of digitized books and RDF resources around, you create a problem in a way. How would people actually use these? They're not educated to do so. And therefore, I used for the title of this slide, the title of a very nice article by Greg Crane, which is about that issue. What do you do with a million books? Do you read them? Actually, the process that I was trying to depict, digitization, semantic publishing, results in growing quantity, in increased complexity, and that goes far beyond human capacities in terms of reading faculty. So we need tools for this. And by the way, in such a context, from a scholarly point of view, the multiplication of collections and distributors is quite an annoying thing. They would probably want to have as few as possible, ideally maybe even one. But anyway, they will need help. And they will help in three areas. They will need help for semantic abstracting, for named entity recognition, to do the contextualization of resources, to enable what Alan Rainier has called strategic reading. They will need help with the actual contextualization job itself, and they would need reasoning and inferencing mechanisms that would yield digital heuristics. So there is a potential for librarians here. But these libraries would have to be very different from today's libraries. I'm not going as far as to state that they should all look like this one. This is the National Library of Galicia in Santiago de Compostela, and this definitely does not look like a library. It's not a very good shape for organizing books. And the inside is not very bookish either. This was the state when it was just opened. I can tell you that even today there are not many books in this building. And people have explained to me that this building was designed for the after-book era. So maybe they don't have all to look like this one, but there will be a number of things that we are used to that will disappear, like this beautiful, emblematic object of desire, the catalog, gone. Like the mark record, could be gone. Even the idea of collections. And here is a nice photo of a collection with a ghost in it, might be gone. It is my conviction that actually to be up to these new opportunities, we need to change terminology. If we want to be part of this linked open data web, we probably need to think about a number of terms. These were terms we have been using for a long time: catalog, document, holdings, information, record, library included, search. And I think that we may be moving into a different terminological paradigm, that we will be talking about aggregations, graphs, discovery, knowledge, context, link, navigation. And you may have noticed that there is no equivalent for the term library in that second cloud. That's not because I think they should disappear, but because I think that we may need a new term, which I haven't yet invented. And this is currently already happening. If you have a look at the Google Ngram environment and take two terms, the one is digitale Bibliotheken, the other is Bibliotheksbestand. The blue one is Bibliotheksbestand, the red one is digitale Bibliotheken. There is a reverse proportional evolution here. And the same is true in English with library holdings and digital libraries. The same is true for bibliographic records and linked data. If you want to go beyond 2008, that's where Google Ngrams ends, you can go into Google Trends, and then you see that this evolution persists. So basically, this is where I come to the end of my talk. We are still sticking to empty memories. But I do think that Shakespeare is wrong in the quote that I'm using here. "What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name would smell as sweet." This is not true. Things change when you change terminology. So why then do we stick to metaphors? Some of us do because we think that they constitute identity, which I think is a bad reason. Some of us think that they may guarantee institutional persistency. As long as you call a library, it will remain in place, which may be a fallacy as well. Some of us are simply afraid of substantial changes and believe that things change only when we use new terms, which I think is dangerous. Or is it simply because we do not have the new terms yet? That may be an acceptable reason, but then let us start looking for them. So this is what you get when you invite a German professor. You get reading in the end of a keynote. Most of the items on this list here I've already mentioned. I'd like to mention explicitly the third one, which is quite frightening in a way. David Perry's presentation, "Burn the Boats, Burn the Books." This is not an invitation to burn your books, but an invitation to think about what would happen if we did that. And this is where I want to thank you for your patience and attention. Thank you.